This is KUNC's Colorado Edition, and I'm Carly Huckles. This week, the city of Longmont has approved 4 pot shops, which will open this year. That's an attractive prospect if you're in the marijuana business.
Denver is oversaturated with dispensaries compared to Longmont, and I think we will do just well here. We'll do really well.
We'll look at the fierce competition among dispensaries. Then we look at the convergence of science and theater. Later in Boulder, there's talk of banning so-called assault weapons. And after that, a review of Oh Lucy from Howie Mofsovitz. But first, within 20 years, Muslims are likely to be the second largest religious group in the United States. And it's driving a demand for halal. That's food prepared according to the Islamic religious customs. As KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, halal meats are becoming an increasing part of the American diet, and consumers probably don't realize it.
At the Superior Farms plant in Denver, music plays as workers break down lamb carcasses into loin chops, shanks, and racks. It's all 100% halal. Shane McKenzie oversees operations and says a halal slaughter isn't that much different than a non-halal slaughter.
Exactly the same other than the practicing Muslim.
Which is the first requirement in producing halal meat. Today, Muslim slaughterman Ahmad Adin Egunwa is working the floor. After each lamb is humanely stunned into unconsciousness, Egunwa faces east towards Mecca and says a prayer before cutting the animal's throat, draining the blood away and quickly killing the lamb.
I have to mention the God name. For each one. Bismillah Allahu Akbar for each one.
That's Bismillahi Allahu Akbar, which translates to in God's name. Egunwa will repeat that prayer about 900 times, which would sound something like
Bismillah Allahu Akbar.
As he Allahu and Akbar. Another Muslim slaughterman will process up to 1,800 lambs a day. Each step in this process follows the same federal regulations required of all slaughterhouses. Superior Farms is also approved by a certifying halal board. McKenzie will often give tours to Muslim priests who want to see the operations for themselves.
So their biggest concern when they come through the plant is, one, do we have practicing Muslims who are doing the kill? And then, are we processing products in our plant that could be considered non-halal?
Like pork or animals that have been given antibiotics since they can contain pork byproducts. Halal also requires animals to be treated humanely and that the meat is fresh and clean. The process for certifying halal meats isn't yet mainstream, so there's little data on the industry. But U.S. sales for halal foods and beverages reached about $2 billion in 2015, a 15% rise in just 3 years. And one of the top meat producers, American Foods Group, says on its website that it's among the top U.S. suppliers of halal meats. Superior Farms VP of Sales Greg Ahart says for years, the company processed halal meat just one day a week.
And it really got to be too cumbersome as time went by to maintain inventory segregation on the product that was halal versus the product that wasn't halal.
Superior's products are sold at small ethnic grocery stores where the meat is clearly marked and advertised as halal. But they're also sold at retail giants where the halal designation isn't always visible.
Now there is where it starts to get interesting.
Ahart says some large chain stores are apprehensive to sell products marked as halal, especially in areas that don't have large Muslim populations. They forego the halal label altogether, so there's no way to tell. Haroon Latif is a research analyst with a prominent marketing company on the U.S. halal market. He says this is fairly common.
They may feel that it's not necessary to mention it's halal, and in some cases, they may fear a backlash, unfortunately, that this does happen.
His company, Dinar Standard, analyzed social media posts with the word halal in 2016. Nearly 20% were Islamophobic and were more likely to come from Europe, Australia, and the U.S. Latif says that sentiment led some retailers to dismiss halal. In 2015, customers of the burger chain Shake Shack began asking on Twitter whether the company served halal meat. Latif says Shake Shack does buy meat from a known halal-certified supplier, but Shake Shack denied it on Twitter, and its website says halal meat is only available at UK and Middle East locations. For now, Latif says those seeking halal meats can shop at specialty stores or consult trusted websites. But he's confident that will change.
I think the push will come when they realize that there is a net benefit to advertising halal.
And that, he says, means retailers will put aside fear for opportunity.
That's KUNC's Esther Honig. Now let's catch up with a few news items. The Union of Concerned Scientists released a report this week saying that the Department of Agriculture has sidelined science and betrayed farmers. As Ray Ellen Bichelle reports, the group is particularly concerned about the use of antibiotics.
Farmers across the U.S., including in this region, routinely use antibiotics on their animals. But the World Health Organization recently came out with some new guidelines for them. Try not to use antibiotics just to make animals grow faster. Use them to treat animals that are sick.
And that is exactly what we should be doing.
That's Karen Stillerman, a senior analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists. She says overusing antibiotics can lead to bacteria that's resistant to drugs, drugs that are used to treat sick people. But the USDA says the new guidelines are based on bad science. Stillerman bristles at that statement.
The science is really strong. Routine use of antibiotics is driving antibiotic resistance in this country.
And overuse in agriculture, she says, is a big part of the problem. In a report out this week called Betrayal by the USDA, Stillerman writes that the USDA is betraying science and the public in favor of policies that will help big business. The USDA did not respond for comment.
In Boulder County, officials want a federal agency reviewing the expansion of a reservoir in the county's foothills to halt the project. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more.
Gross Reservoir is managed by Denver Water, and for more than a decade, they've wanted to make the lake bigger. But Conrad Lattice with the Boulder County Attorney's Office says Denver Water hasn't proven it needs the added water storage.
It would be the largest construction project in our county's history, and it provides no benefit to the citizens of Boulder County.
Denver Water says it's still projecting an imbalance between water demand and supply in future years. Their plan is being considered by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Boulder County could also challenge the Water Management Agency on a land use permit, which would tie up the project in court.
Governor John Hickenlooper has signed a bill that will provide funding to expand high-speed internet in rural areas of the state. Supporters say fast internet service is critical for telemedicine, public schools, and farmers. Democratic State Senator Kerry Donovan is working on that and other measures to improve rural economies.
It is surprising to have seen the progress we made this year after hitting so many dead ends over previous sessions. So it's very exciting, but we can't stop here. We still have more to do, but this is a great start.
The bill will take money from a fund that has subsidized rural telephone service and invest it in broadband construction over a five-year period ending in 2023. It's estimated that more than $115 million will go into broadband grants between 2019 and 2023. Now to recreational marijuana, which is a billion-dollar industry in Colorado. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that there is a lot of competition among dispensaries to be the first to set up shop in Longmont. Until recently, the city banned the sale of pot, as KUNC's Matt Bloom reports.
Last October, the Longmont City Council decided to offer four retail marijuana licenses to serve its population of roughly 96,000 residents.
I think there was a fear among some community members that if we had, you know, say 10 stores come into town, that that impact on the community would be greater.
That's Assistant City Manager Sean Lewis. Money collected from a new city sales tax on pot will be used to fund affordable housing projects. Lewis wants the dispensaries to hire locally to help support their growing economy.
We've really reached a point where we're on the radar for a lot of national type, companies, businesses. We've had a lot of job growth.
The city's received 13 applications from large and small companies. And while a final decision hasn't been made, one dispensary is already hiring staff. The Green Solution operates 14 stores around the state. Back in February, they hosted a job fair.
So we're one of 13. It's a merit-based system, so all the applications are merit-based.
Todd Mitchum is a cannabis industry consultant who heads government relations for the company. He says every community has its own process for awarding licenses, and Longmont is no exception.
Have you had a lot of violations? Do you follow the rules? You know, do you care about public health and safety? Do you have a plan for community outreach? So there are lots of criteria.
Does hosting fairs like this in the community give you an edge?
You know, we are demonstrating that we are community collaborators and connectors. We want to be active in the community, not just run in and, you know, open up our store and forget about the community except for their purchases. We believe it's us just being authentic in the space, you know. So, yeah, so I hope it does. I mean, that would be great. It'd be a great benefit if it did.
Rita Salyuk is also interested in opening up a dispensary in Longmont. She and her business partner have invested in a conditional lease in a small shopping mall in the southwest part of town.
We're very proud of this location. This is really cool. Tons of parking, easy access.
There's a family-owned bakery next door, a GameStop, and a Smashburger across the street. This would be Salyuk's second dispensary location and a big deal for her growing Denver-based business.
Denver is oversaturated with dispensaries compared to Longmont. I think there is a need and desire of people to have some. And I think we will do just well here. We'll do really well.
The 4,500 square foot space is currently empty. There's a wheelbarrow in the corner sitting on top of an unfinished floor. And Salyuk knows that she might not make the final four. And the city is not without its critics of the licensing plan.
State law does not supersede federal law when federal law is already in existence.
Councilmember Gabe Santos voted against lifting Longmont's ban on pot shops last fall.
You want this changed? Change at the federal level. Then let's have the discussion.
Patricio Yanis is also against it. He's a local resident who works with at-risk youth.
If we open up four dispensaries in our city, I can guarantee you that is the number one reason why many homeless people will choose to come here and will choose to set up here and choose to live here.
Okay.
Back in his office, Assistant City Manager Sean Lewis continues sorting through the applications. He's also working with the police chief, the community services director, and a municipal court judge.
They are being advised by all city staff who are providing information, again, about the neighborhood impact, about how good the business plan looks, about how good the security plan for each business is. And so we're going to be looking at all of those criteria as a staff and then providing recommendations.
The public has also weighed in, and the Colorado Marijuana Enforcement Division has signed off on the applications. A final decision by the city is expected later this spring or summer.
As we just heard, there's a lot of competition to be among the next marijuana shops in Longmont. Matt Bloom joins me now. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Carly.
So you had some sources in your story that were concerned about shops opening. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Right. So I thought it was important to hear from people who weren't exactly super excited about dispensaries coming into Longmont. And we heard concerns about homelessness from one person. We heard concerns about the legality of marijuana at a local and at a federal level, I mean. And then one person we didn't hear from in the story that I wanted to include, but there wasn't time, was one of the council members had this really interesting anecdote about how he was driving in his car with his kids, and his kids were asking about marijuana coming to Longmont. And they asked, like, Daddy, are you going to let stores come into town? And he's like, no, I'm not, because it's not good for kids. So there's still this, you know, fear from parents in the community that we heard from that, you know, by bringing dispensaries into their community, that their children were going to be in danger from that. And so that was the reasoning behind why one of the council members voted against it.
So you said that there were how many vying for these four options?
13 total.
13 total. How long do you think it's going to take for them to decide who gets those spots?
Recently, all 13 were given the thumbs up by the state's Marijuana Enforcement Division. So now it's sort of this vague timeline that the city has of spring or summer, essentially.
Okay.
And they're sort of right now in talks to do it. The first stores should be opening by the end of the summer.
When you were looking at doing this story, were there any questions that didn't get answered?
Yes. I think that there are a lot of communities we're seeing right now across Colorado that are voting to legalize the sale of marijuana. And what we didn't get to in the story, which I would like to look at, is the number of communities that still have yet to lift the ban in Colorado and how the industry is competing in other places, not just Longmont, to be the first to open stores there.
It'll be an interesting story to follow. We're looking forward to you keeping us up to date on how this all goes. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Carly.
Now to arts reporter Stacey Nick. She takes us to a world debut of a new play that's happening in Northern Colorado this week. While the story contains all the hallmarks of a good drama, romance, tension, and comedy, it also has a healthy dose of science.
When Jeffrey Bigger heard about the subject matter of Babu Theater's upcoming show, he wasn't exactly sold.
I thought, really, someone's written a play about dirt. And then they asked me to assistant direct, and I said, could I read it first?
The story of Dirt, a Terra Nova Expedition, follows a young Fort Collins scientist surviving in an underground bunker after a catastrophic event. She's trapped there as she waits for the soil above her to heal.
And as soon as I read the opening scene to the play, I knew it was something that I had to do.
Oh, Leopold, what have we done?
This play started with an essay I wrote about bacteria in the soil and in my gut and how both needed to be fostered. But I wanted to turn that into something dramatic.
Now, what author Laura Pritchett is saying may sound a little odd. After all, how fun can fungi really be? But then you see the dancing nematodes. That's right, dancing roundworms.
Nematodes, yes! So tiny, yet gods.
I mean, I really am in love with science and soil science and the things we cannot see. And I wondered, what would it be like to get that on the stage? Get nematodes dancing on a stage, get bacteria singing, and bring it all to life so that it's visible to the human eye.
It's very, very challenging because you're trying to pack in the information, but also make it an engaging story.
Wendy Ishii is BaBlue's founding artistic director. She says the spark behind Dirt began in her living room as she and Pritchett watched the documentary Symphony of the Soil. The discussion then turned to how to get people to understand the critical role that soil plays and why we must protect it.
Well, we just went, let's put it on the stage. That's kind of how the world gets changed, is through stories.
And so the seed was planted.
For most of my writing career, that's been one of my great goals, is to bring science into the artistic world.
That meant Pritchett had to figure out how to tell her story in a riveting and dramatic way to draw audiences in. She worked with local soil and climate scientists to make sure both art and science played leading roles.
Because I can really geek out on science. The whole play could be 3 hours of science, but I tell you, it's not. The trick is walking the fine line of picking out the most interesting and relevant points of cutting-edge science, what we know about soil, for example, or carbon sequestration, or climate change, or bacteria or fungi, and bring it out to a story that involves love and compassion and tears and fear. And then you're not preaching to the audience about, you know, you should know this, this, and this about science.
It's made a believer out of director Jeffrey Bigger. He says he's already made changes to his day-to-day life, driving less and recycling more.
I want people not to look at the title and go, Dirt, a Terra Nova expedition, and go, I don't want to go watch a play about dirt. Yes, you do. You really do. Trust me, you want to go learn about dirt. And when you do learn about dirt, it will change you.
Because art needs science, and science, Pritchett says, needs art, which is why she wants scientists to see the play and get inspired to use art in their work.
I hope that they say, somebody saw what I see, which is we have 6 inches of stuff saving us from oblivion, and it is beautiful and complex and gorgeous, and no one has, you know, appreciated it the way I have, and now they can.
And Pritchett hopes that once they have seen it, they'll want to dig a little deeper.
What if this was a theater? I cast color. I cast dancing. I cast history. I cast science.
That's KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick. Now to the city of Boulder, which is considering a ban of so-called assault weapons. City Attorney Tom Carr has drafted a law that would make it illegal to sell or possess certain semi-automatic firearms, as well as bump stocks and high-capacity magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Carr spoke with KUNC's Kyra Buckley about why the city council is moving in this direction.
What's the concern that the city council was addressing? Why did they ask you to take a look at this?
Well, this was immediately after the Parkland, Florida shooting. It seems that assault weapons are used very frequently in the mass killings that we've seen, particularly in schools. And as a community of with a large number of students, the council has a concern about protecting their lives.
What is your definition or the city's definition of assault weapon?
Well, that's a not an easy thing to do. What we did was we looked at the model ordinance that the Giffords Law Center has. It's an organization named after Gabby Giffords that promotes reasonable gun control laws. And the definition of assault weapon is defined to address the concerns about the increased lethality of these weapons. And the things that makes them more lethal is their capacity to fire a large number of bullets quickly. And the things that allow that are the capacity to hold a large capacity magazine and the ability to stabilize the gun for repeated pulling of the trigger.
Do we have any idea how many of these devices exist in Boulder?
No. And one of the things the council made clear to me was they want to both consider a ban on sales and then separately a ban on possession. So it may be that they decide only to ban sales. We have two gun shops in Boulder that sell these weapons, and that's a concern of council, one of which is located almost directly across the street from Boulder High School.
Is there any precedence for this anywhere else, either in Colorado or in the country, that's proposed something like this, that you were able to kind of, you know, either reach out and ask for some guidance or looking at laws to model yours after?
Yeah, I think there's six states that ban assault weapons. Denver and Vail both have had assault weapon bans for some time. We modeled our ordinance after all of those.
There are folks that are already saying if any portion of this law passes, they plan to challenge it in court. I know that's kind of far along to think about, but have you thought about that? And do maybe some of those previous places that have these laws in place, have they won court cases of people that have challenged their laws?
Yes. So Denver's law was challenged in the early 2000s, and the district court in Denver upheld the assault weapons ban. It was an excellent decision that goes through to address what were matters of specific local concern for Denver. That decision was appealed to the Supreme Court. One of the justices had to recuse herself, so the court split 3-3. So that affirmed it for Denver, but had no precedential effect for anybody else. So there's no controlling law in the state of Colorado on whether or not a home rule city can ban assault weapons. Although, as I said, both Denver's and Vail have been in place, I think, since the 90s.
I'm wondering if there's just something that you would want, if somebody, not a lawyer, was looking at this, what would you want them to walk away knowing?
Counsel's concern and specific instruction was that they are not trying to affect lawful gun owners in Boulder. They are trying to do something that raises some level of protection for the kids in our town.
That was KUNC's Kyra Buckley talking with the Boulder City Attorney, Tom Carr. A new movie called Oh, Lucy starts with a Japanese woman learning English, then swings from Tokyo to California. And whatever she learns makes no difference. Let's check in with KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver. He says the swings are sometimes delightful and sometimes not.
At the start of Oh, Lucy, Setsuko, played by Shinobu Terajima, stands in a crowd waiting for a train. It's cold and flu season, so like most of the others, Setsuko wears a mask. Her eyes, though, look sad. Later, without the mask, she still looks sad and a good bit uncertain. Something terrible happens on the train platform, but you get the feeling that what ails Setsuko came much earlier. Setsuko's niece wrangles her into taking English lessons, which do not look promising. Setsuko sat down a long hallway with closed doors on either side. It looks like some kind of sex club. When she enters room 301, she meets her teacher for the private lesson. He's an aggressive young American named John, Josh Hartnett, who immediately teaches her casual phrases like, "Hi, and how you doing?" and insists that they share a big American hug. Setsuko's reticent and Japanese, a society not big on American-style hugs. She looks like she's caught in a vice. Learning the high five comes next, and then John tells Setsuko her name is now Lucy. She's been hugged and renamed in about a minute. John also slaps a frightful blonde wig on her. It's hard to tell if he's teaching her English or running a clown workshop. Oh, Lucy's written and directed by Atsuko Hirayanagi, a young woman making just her second feature, who has a freewheeling sense of story and character. Oh, Lucy veers between farce and sadness. The niece runs away to America, with John, it turns out, and on an impulse, Setsuko and her sister, the mother of the niece, fly off to Los Angeles to track her down. Everybody's at odds. Setsuko and her sister argue throughout the movie. The niece doesn't want to be found. And John is an entire story unto himself. Director Hiraya Nagi seems right at home with the garish side of life. Setsuko, her sister, and John wind up in a dreary salmon-colored motel with a pouty, self-important young slob sitting behind a plate glass window at the office. As Setsuko wanders the streets late at night, hoping to mail a postcard, a huge, menacing guy in a tank top turns out friendly and simply shows her how to use a mailbox. Oh, Lucy's genuinely original and surprising. The film doesn't prepare you for what's coming or how it all might end. But inside the emotional zigs and zags, Oh, Lucy's a picture of dislocation and loneliness. Setsuko in a San Diego tattoo parlor late at night may be a funny sight, but what got her there is not. At first, her sudden shifts of behavior suggest a delightful spirit, but then you see the desperation. She's unmoored, she's disconnected from other people and her own life. And what surfaces is her blocked need to find companionship. The social world in Oh, Lucy doesn't have much holding it together. At Setsuko's job, an older woman about to retire is handed a grotesque flower arrangement, along with her boss's insincere statement about the next chapter in life. The woman pretends gratitude, but the image of her alone at a subway stop indicates that emptiness and loneliness are on the way. People are always going somewhere and getting nowhere. Human interactions either angry or coldly isolated. Setsuko tries to make contact with a kind of random sexual hunger that pops out at the wrong time with the wrong person. Oh, Lucy throws out the kinds of sharp, sudden actions that make you yelp and then wonder if you're laughing or gasping. It leaves you unsettled and distrustful, but always attracted to what's going on and what may be coming. The picture's at the same time charming and baffling. It flirts with disasters and then pulls back. But you can never trust that the next time won't lead to complete ruin. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
One last little item. If you find yourself both loving and loathing the idea of starting your spring cleaning, it's not just in your head. Well, maybe it is. KUNC's Stacey Nick explains.
Procrastinating any big undertaking, like the annual spring cleanup, is the brain's way of protecting itself, according to Dr. Randall O'Reilly, psychology and neuroscience professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. That's because the brain is wired to track progress. Once you start a project, it takes over your brain. And if the positive outcome isn't assured, your brain may be overly cautious about taking it on.
In some ways, it's quite rational. Should you actually invest all this time and energy cleaning up your house, or should you do something that's more immediately rewarding? And, you know, the brain is really optimized to derive pleasure, to get these dopamine bursts. And so it is actually a bit of a mystery why we take on something like spring cleaning.
O'Reilly says the answer may be in the brain's equal love for order, the same reason people like to make lists that they can check accomplishments off of. Every time you complete a task, your brain releases more dopamine, one of the so-called feel-good hormones. Completing tasks literally makes you feel good.
So when you're sitting there thinking, should I, you know, start spring cleaning, your brain is basically weighing that pleasure of getting things organized against all the effort and cost that it's going to require.
So is there a way to encourage your brain to forge ahead? O'Reilly says the key is to start small. Tricking your brain into releasing some dopamine for finishing a small task will help you keep working so that you can complete a bigger one.
That's KUNC's Stacey Nick, and that's Colorado Edition for this week. Our show was produced by news director Michael Deiwana and me. Editors Brian Larson, Aaron O'Toole, and Ashley Jeffcoat contributed to our show. Our intro music was Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. Other music in this show includes David Hillovitz with his song Daylight Savings, Rick Strafford with his song October 9, Spinning Ratio, Long Way Home, and Uncanny with Grasp. The outro music was Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you heard and you want to hear more, subscribe on iTunes or Google Play and be sure to write a review. We want your feedback and it'll help others find Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles. Make sure to join me next Friday.